You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
How seriously do college teachers consider their roles in creating a fulfilling undergraduate experience for their students? Well, in his new book, Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students, Jacques Berlinblau, the director of the Center for Jewish Civilization at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, examines the state of modern academia. It's published by Melville House. Professor Berlinblau, who holds separate doctorates in ancient Near Eastern languages and literatures and in sociology, joins us now. Welcome back to our show.
Hi, Leonard. Great to be here.
You're a tenured professor at Georgetown. Does that make it safer for you to take this critical look at academia and higher education?
Absolutely. I really wanted to use my tenure, so I really used it here. Only a tenured professor, I feel, could write a book like this.
It would have been dangerous for somebody else.
Yeah, it would have been. An assistant professor could not even have the independent thought of conceiving such a text. Maybe there are some adjuncts, the exploited amongst us, that do write books like this, though they look at it a little bit differently.
Did you base it mostly on your own, what you had observed, or did you actually do research?
It's funny. I've written 7 books. This is the first one where I didn't do research in the classic scholarly sense. I was reading other people's research. I wasn't sequestered in an archive somewhere or interviewing people in obscure languages. So I was reading other people's research, and almost fictionally, I was trying to dredge, like a seance, these 25 years of bizarre experiences that I've had as a college professor.
What about your experiences as an undergraduate?
Yeah, that as well, because as an undergraduate, I went to NYU right here in the Village, and I never did find that professor who I wish I might have found, right? I have names for these types of characters throughout the book, but that person, she or he, wasn't there, and I aspire to be that person, at least for my students at Georgetown. So maybe there's a little bit of a quest in all of this.
You aspire to be what kind of a person?
A professor. There are various types of professors that I discuss in the text.
Well, you say that humanities scholars are fuddy-duddies. Yeah. Most of them or all of them?
Oh, I'm a fuddy-duddy. I'm the king of the fuddy-duddy. We all are, right? And that has to do with the way we're trained in graduate school. There's no way to be a professor of the humanities or even in the liberal arts and not be this type of fuddy-duddy. That's what all the campus novels understand about us, how peculiar we are.
Well, those campus novels are all about the politics of working within a department. Mm-hmm. How important are the politics of a department?
Politics are huge. I was having a discussion with somebody earlier today, somebody in the Wall Street world, who was saying, yeah, amongst you academics, it's all power, right? You can't make a lot of money, right? You can't get comped at the end of the year. There's no big bonus. So it's all power for you guys. So you've got to like really hold on to it. And these power places, you know, Leonard, I'm guessing, are just pathetic, and they're funny, and they're the stuff of fiction, essentially.
A friend who should have been given tenure at one of the city universities got recommendations from a whole bunch of people, and he was walking to a class when the head of the English department said to him, you know, just because Susan Sontag wrote a recommendation doesn't mean you're getting it.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Sounds about right.
You talk about the pressures in academia that nothing short of godly omniscience is demanded of the specialist. Mm. How much pressure does that put on a teaching experience?
I think our whole model is wrong. We train people in graduate school. Graduate school, on average, in the humanities is 10 years. All right, that's longer than medical school. So you could sooner mend a pancreas than deliver a peer-reviewed paper on Caravaggio. I mean, I find that incredibly bizarre how much time it takes. What happens in graduate school is we sort of strain out many of the qualities that make one an effective undergraduate teacher, right? So we're very, very isolated. We're working alone. We're working on issues that no one else cares about. And these are extremely specialized issues. And I'm just wondering if what we need to do in this great leap forward I'd like us all to take is to rethink how we train an American scholar and what we expect them to do.
How important is individual research in the process? What's the balance between research and teaching?
Yeah, it's huge. So we have an expression, you hear it all the time, work-life balance. And Leonard, I assume you think that's really important, right? Work-life balance is important. We don't have research teaching balance at our top 50, top 100, top 150 universities. We don't expect our tenure line faculty to have some type of symbiotic relationship between those two essential tasks. And what generally happens is the path to tenure is more and more peer-reviewed scholarly research.
Aren't the really famous ones who are wooed to universities told you're not going to have to teach too many classes?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the game, right? The entire game of being a tenure-line professor in the United States is how do I convince my dean and provost to not make me deal with those schmucky undergraduates, right? That's the game, and we all play that game. But I think the game has caught us. There's an expression in French, quand on joue, on est joué. When we play, we are played. And I feel as a guild, we are now being played because we played this game so well.
You write a lot about the tenure process in this book. How does one achieve tenure?
By effectively barricading themselves from any substantive form of human interaction with anyone else for about 7 years.
Well, that's a sarcastic version.
That's the only way to do it. I have a whole unit on assistant professors and what it's like to be an assistant professor. And I have a little joke to the undergraduate. The assistant professor is not the person you want to talk about. You want to talk to about the series you binge watched on Netflix the night, but they're just not there for you. They have 6 years to justify the previous 15 years of educational investments they've made. And if they get tenure, it's nirvana. It's just they've won the lottery.
But they're assistant professors. What's the difference between an assistant professor and an associate professor?
At most universities, an assistant professor is on the tenure track, and it means they have anywhere from 4 to 7 years to prove to their department that they are worthy of being tenured. And if they're tenured, I repeat, they have a job for life and full academic freedom.
Has it always been thus?
Yeah,
have things changed over the years?
So what's changing? The institution of tenure as we know it is born in 1940 because of a great organization, the American Association of University Professors. It served us very, very well. In the 70s, something like 56% of all American professors were tenured, and then something happened, and we are watching the slow demise and extinction of the tenure system.
And that's partly because it's less expensive to have associates and assistants.
Absolutely, and full professors, right? Never forget the fulls.
But full is not necessarily tenured.
No, that's tenured. It's funny. So in the book, I have a little riff on how the educated laypersons, civilians, undergraduates, do not understand our rigid hierarchies in higher ed. They wouldn't know a provost from a postdoc. Mm. To us, it's so important, right? We're a very stratified guild, right? But no one understands our internal stratification and weirdness.
My guess is Jacques Berliner-Blau, whose latest book is Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. Well, I mentioned earlier what happened to my friend. Does the opinion of coworkers have an impact on your chance of obtaining tenure?
Yeah, my advice to the assistant professor, that's the person who's up for tenure, is make no enemies anywhere on earth. And that's essentially what an assistant professor must do. Do not cross any scholar in your field. And just to be safe, don't cross any scholar in any other field.
If you're already tenured and you decide you want to go to a different school, do you automatically obtain tenure at the new job?
That's called lateral appointment. Lateral appointment is extremely difficult to pull off. I don't have statistics on this for you, but from what I understand, it's kind of a 1 in 1,000 thing. Basically, when you get tenure, you're locked in. And maybe this is why studies show, I find this incredible, that associate professors, that's the people who just got tenure, they won the jackpot, are the least happy of all the professorial levels on every single one of the criteria that we mentioned. So there's something that happens, you get tenure, and then I think you feel locked in, or why did I do this, or is this all there is? And then you get very, very depressed as an associate.
But mostly it's contingent faculty these days.
All right, so that's...
You say nearly 71% of professors can be parsed into the contingent destination.
That's the shame of our guild, and that's what we have to rectify immediately. We've been yucking it up, the two of us, talking about the tenure line and all their foibles, right? But the tragic story in American higher education is up to 3/4 of the 1.5 million professors in the United States are referred to as contingent faculty, which means they work under deplorable conditions, they are poorly paid, they have no job security, and they have no academic freedom protections. That's what you get with tenure.
And you say there's a difference between the contingent of hope and the contingent of the damned?
Right. The contingent of hope are kind of the postdocs, the youngsters, the people that are adjuncting at four different universities when they're fresh out of graduate school, and they think they might have a chance at that tenure track job. So they're applying and they're applying. And this is basically like 90% of people who get their doctorate in the humanities go through this 3-year period where they're underemployed, but they have a lot of hope that through their prodigious talent and their brilliance, somebody will notice them and they will get that tenure track job.
What happens if you're already famous, if you're a famous writer or a famous artist, maybe didn't even graduate from college? You could still be given a tenured professorship?
You could. It's less. It used to happen a lot in literature. What's the famous essay? Is it an Irving Howe essay or is it Russell Jacoby? I'm thinking of an essay about how in the 50s and 60s with great writers and essayists, they could get tenure. Basically now the field has become so professionalized and there's so few tenure jobs anyhow that we ain't giving it to anyone without a doctorate.
And you write that 25% of part-time college faculty are on some kind of public assistance?
It's a scandal. It's an absolute scandal. Well, it's probably worse than that. And these are really good people. Often they're better published than the person that nabbed the tenure track job who they were competing with, right? So I call this the crisis of standardlessness.
So this is all a matter of colleges saving money? Why do you think colleges aren't putting their money into what one would think is the most important part of a college education?
There's like this military-industrial complex of economists who study the American university. So there are different theories. So one theory is that the only thing that interests college and universities in the United States is driving down teaching costs to their absolute lowest level because they really don't care that much about the quality of undergraduate education. That's my preferred theory. Another theory is that the tenure system is unwieldy and too expensive, and we have to get rid of it to be economically viable.
Is it different with the schools that everybody wants to go to? Do Yale and Harvard pay better than, I don't know, that school whose name kind of pops up every once in a while?
My personal view is the situation there is worse because the star faculty at Yale and Harvard do not have to teach undergraduates. So what are you getting? You're getting those contingent faculty. They might be paid a little bit better. My university, Georgetown, we actually are okay in terms of how we compensate our contingent faculty. But you're not getting the person whose TED Talk you heard, right? That person isn't in the same hemisphere as you when you get to campus in the fall.
But those are the destination colleges.
I call those the destination colleges.
And there's a two-tiered division of labor at the destination college?
At every college in America. And the two-tiered division goes like this. Those on the tenure line, those are the assistants, the associates, and the fulls, can avoid undergraduates often enough. They get to teach graduate students or they get to travel to conferences or barricade themselves in an archive. And most of the undergraduate teaching is performed by these poorly paid and professionally disrespected contingent faculty, and that's especially true at the elite schools.
And is anybody paying attention to how they're teaching? Some obviously are better than others.
Yeah, that's one of the great, like, teaching is the mystery meat of American higher education, probably because nobody can enter a classroom. I do a little section on this. It's very curious. This must be a medieval thing. I don't know where it comes from. Amongst professors, the custom is you never enter another professor's classroom unless you have explicit written consent to do so. So we often don't know what happens in American classrooms. Only undergraduates know, and they're often sleeping or hungover or not really paying attention.
I'm speaking with Jacques Berliner Blau, professor and director of the Center for Jewish Civilization at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. His latest book is called Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. It's published by Melville House. We will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Professor Jacques Berliner Blau. His latest book, Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students, published by Melville House. Let's talk about graduate school. Do many students who attend grad school have the intention of teaching?
Teaching? No. I think most folks get into graduate school without really understanding what it takes to be a professor. They don't understand the degree of hard, micro-specialized, I would say dull, research they have to perform in order to be a professional scholar.
It's very different than if you want to teach in a high school or an elementary school. You have to take ed classes.
Absolutely.
There are no preparatory classes for teaching on a college level?
Isn't that amazing? Now, there are some schools, I heard that Emory is experimenting with this. So there are some schools that are starting. I mean, it just hit them. We've been a guild now for 500 years. So we've just had the insight in the last decade that perhaps it might be a good thing to train our graduate students in pedagogy. Wow.
There are all these, this alphabet soup involved. There's the ABD period, and then there are the flacks and the slacks.
The flacks are the famous liberal arts colleges that I'm a little bit suspicious of, and the slacks are the small liberal arts colleges that you've never heard of, and I just have a weird fondness for those types of schools.
Do you think you get a better education in them?
Well, the first thing is I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I'm a city boy, right? So I go to these schools, and they're out in the middle of nowhere. I can't even believe they exist. So that's my first sense of awe when I visit their campus. Often those schools, though, and this is very interesting, they have a reputation as these sleepy backwaters, and they sure look the part, right? But because a 5% drop in the size of the incoming freshman class can spell financial doom for these people, they tend to be very innovative, innovative in ways that the top 50, top 100 are not.
So you say good scholars end up at not good schools and vice versa?
All the time. This is that crisis of standardlessness. I've written about this in the Chronicle of Higher Education. There are so few jobs. Let me give you an example. When we put out an advertisement for a tenure line job, we might get anywhere from 200 to 700 applications for one tenure line job. And we're not talking just the best universities, right? What happens is the committees often make mistakes, all right, because we're fallible and we're dysfunctional. But that's another story for another day. So a person ends up at top 10 university and somebody else ends up at university ranked 150. And if you measure their CVs when they were hired, they're identical. And then you look 10 years on and you find out that the person at like Oklahoma State has outpublished the person at University of Pennsylvania. It's very, very peculiar. There's tremendous homogeneity amongst the talent level, I would say, and the production level of tenure line professors at major American universities.
So how do you decide which teacher is the best for which, or the best fit?
Well, teaching, right? So what I like to do is...
You don't watch them teach. You have no...
It isn't the
same thing as if you're going to publish somebody's book. You have the book. You can say, this is a good book or this is not a good book.
Yeah, I have a little goof in the book about the difference between drafts in the NFL and the way we draft our scouts. Drafts in the NFL, you've got television, you've got millions of dollars, and you've got scouts, and they're looking at film. We basically spend about 10 to 15 minutes looking over resumes, and then we create a short list, and we bring them to campus. And what could possibly go wrong under those circumstances? The people making the decisions aren't paid to do it, obviously. Politics, everything. It all summates to produce often a not very good decision.
You argue that the very structure of doctoral programs makes it almost impossible for PhDs to ever succeed as teachers.
Right. I think we strain out all the good pedagogical impulses in those 10 years, and I would point to the isolation in particular. Now, I went to graduate school twice. All right? I have two doctorates, so I think I know of what I speak. That experience was so incredibly alienating. To me, it's funny in retrospect, but the amount of time I didn't spend with any other human being clearly left a mark on my psyche and my ability to communicate, and it nullified, it nuked whatever emotional intelligence I might have possessed, which apparently wasn't much when I went into graduate school.
Aren't the tenured professors more likely to be teaching huge classes, what you call massification?
Yeah, massification. Yes and no. Often that's contingent faculty. I repeat, the tenured professor's game is not to teach undergraduates, to avoid them at any cost. Often a concession with the dean is, we'll stick you in front of 250 students, and that will be your load for this semester, and you can get some research leave the next semester. What I want to say is this. I don't want to come across as if saying there are no great teachers. There are great teachers. In the country. I refer to them as my people in the book, and I feel that on every college campus, 10 to 25% of that faculty actually really cares and wants to teach and wants to mentor and wants to work with those undergraduates.
My experience in college was there were a couple of different types. There were the academic types who knew the way things were and would not hear anything else. And then there were the ones who really worked with you and in some cases could change your life.
That's what I think college delivers. When college works, right, you take 40 classes roughly to get your bachelor's, right? There are 40 opportunities with maybe 35 or 36 professors. When it works well, two or three of them alter the trajectory of your life. Apparently, it happened to you. It didn't happen to me as an undergrad. It happened to me in graduate school, luckily. But those are, I'd like the percentage to be higher, not 3 out of 40. Maybe 12 out of 40 could potentially alter the trajectory of your life.
Well, it doesn't matter whether they were great on outside of school or not. I was an art student, and I studied with a number of really famous artists. Perhaps the greatest of them, Mark Rothko, was a terrible teacher.
So, but did you learn a lot from him?
I learned nothing from him.
Oh, okay.
That's a whole other matter. Jonathan from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling because I think it's clear that the guest has a skewed perspective or is presenting a skewed perspective on American higher education, because he's talking primarily about those elite colleges. As a tenured faculty member of a New York City university that is not considered elite, I can say from my own experience, and most universities in the United States work this way, we teach undergraduates all the time. We invest a tremendous amount of energy into our pedagogy and into the students, the individual students we teach. We do not receive a great deal of research funding, so I do not bury myself in an archive. I do not have graduate students. That is, in fact, the state of most universities and most faculty members across the United States. What he's talking about are the highest level of universities, and that is not representative of what is going on.
Want to defend yourself?
Yeah, Professor Jeff, yes and no. I see this at community colleges. Right? I think the level of pedagogy at community colleges is actually really, really good. I started my career teaching at a community college. So I would agree with him there. I would respectfully riposte to Jeff that none of us get into this business to teach. That's one. We're never trained how to teach. So the bar is very low for what constitutes great teaching on an American college or university campus. So I'm actually going to stick to my guns here. And I'm not trying to discredit or degrade the hard work that people do. I think all things equal, a great college teacher is a sort of an accident, even at a school that cares.
We actually have a caller who's a chair of the English department at a community college, and I'm going to go to him in just a moment. But a reminder to our listeners that my guest is Jacques Berliner-Blau. His latest book, Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students, published by Melville House. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Bernie from White Plains, you're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I'm not still the chairperson of English at Bronx Community. I retired 15 years ago, and I agree with Professor Jeff a lot. But my main point is costs of colleges have spiraled because of the ever-increasing itinerant administrative group who owe no loyalty to one institution, enact a policy that's unworkable, but leave, and the faculty and everyone else is left to deal with it. I think that's having the expanding administrators drives down the money that is available for improvement in faculty and, indeed, the hiring of full-time faculty.
No, I have a chapter in there on administrators. So what we've learned is administrators have ballooned in the last 40 years. So I forget what the numbers are. I think it's in Chapter 6 or Chapter 7. So I agree that there has been this explosion of administrators. A few caveats to Professor Bernie. A lot of those administrators hold doctorates. Many of them are folks that didn't receive tenure or received tenure and went on to perform administrative tasks. I think there's, as the ship is sinking in American higher ed, you've got the admins over here and you've got the faculty over here, and we're all pointing our fingers at one another. And I want to say this very clearly in the book. I think good administrations led by competent administrators can do a lot of good for professors.
Now, you talk about the role that administration plays in the teaching style of college courses. Mm-hmm. Bernie, was that something that you experienced?
Yes, to some degree, but not really. My point was that there's no loyalty to the institution, and they just keep moving on, and there is no cohesive development within the system because of the free-flowing anxiety that these mobile administrators cause.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I started my career at Kingsborough Community College. So when I speak about what administrators can do, I think this is very important. A good administration incentivizes a faculty intelligently. and tells them, this is what we expect for you to do, and we're going to provide you with the resources, be they financial, right, or instructional, so you can succeed in the classroom. That's what a good administration does.
Who is Rebecca Nathan?
Oh, yeah, she's great. She's an anthropologist who went undercover. I believe it was Northern Arizona State University. She went undercover and lived in the dorms amongst freshmen and sophomores. Nobody could figure this out, even though it was her own university. Apparently, the university was big enough. She was outed. Somebody figured out who she was, which is unfortunate. It's a fascinating study. And she lived with these kids. And her conclusion was sobering. Her conclusion was, they really don't care that much about faculty. We're completely irrelevant to their lives. And their lives are their jobs and their friends and their social networks, right? But faculty are sort of just nugatory to the whole experience.
But they have to choose teachers. And sometimes they don't necessarily choose the teacher who has a reputation for being the best teacher. Sometimes they like a fun professor. Right. Sometimes they like a teacher who they has a reputation for giving high grades.
Yeah, big problem. Big problem. There's a lot of advice to undergraduates and parents of high school seniors in this book. And what I tell undergraduates is, you want to look for the professor who pisses people off. I always find that's the most interesting. The professor that will walk into a classroom, right, and exert the psychic energy to really get a bunch of 18 to 24-year-olds mad is probably a really interesting professor.
You devote a section of the book to professor-student romances. Right. Is that still a major problem?
On the undergraduate level, I think no. So the argument there, I thought this was kind of a fun argument in the book. I talk about a wall of separation that has developed between professors and students, and I don't think it existed in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And I'm trying to figure out where the wall came from. And I do think inadvertently our growing attention to sexual harassment, which was a real thing, right? Professors sexually harassing generally women undergraduates. The positive effect of that is I kind of think we stamped it out. I don't hear too many rumors about professor-student with undergraduates relationships anymore. I really don't hear a lot about that. On the graduate level, yes. But there was something on the backstroke, right? There was like collateral damage there. And collateral damage in the 80s, as I understand it, this idea that the students must be all the way over there and protected from the professors who are all the way over here with the administrators, this goes back to Professor Burney, standing in the middle with legal counsel hovering above them, it kind of created a peculiar feedback effect in which the professors moved further and further and further away from the students. And everyone was cool with that, by the way. Nobody was complaining, but this is what a typical college campus now looks like as a result, that wall of separation.
Who has the ultimate responsibility for creating a fulfilling undergraduate experience, the student or the professor?
The professor. Students are students. They're 18 to 24-year-olds. They're schnooks. When I was 19 years old, I wasn't the smartest guy in the world. Let's stop criticizing the students for being too into material things or they're so late. We can't do that. All right. Our job is to work with 18 to 24-year-olds. All right. So it's on the professor to make the change.
There's been a lot of talk about politics on campuses again. The conservatives who complain that colleges push liberal political ideas. There's been a lot of talk recently about free speech on campuses and the canceling of speeches by people whose political ideas are found unacceptable. Are different schools, how important is politics to the climate of a university?
To an elite university, and this is where Professor Jeff comes back in, immense. I have an article in the Washington Post a couple of weeks back where I say it's true, there are very few conservatives on a humanities faculty. There are studies that show like 2% of English professors, something like that, are registered Republicans. I mean, how is that even possible? I would just urge people not to read American academic culture as they read American political culture. In American political culture, we have a binary. We have blue, red, Democrat, liberal, conservative. We have blue, red, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative. On your typical college campus, you have three camps. And this is what outsiders, especially Fox News, does not understand. Tiny, tiny amount of conservatives, a graying cohort of liberals, and a very formidable column of what I would call the radical left. And I want to emphasize, these are serious scholars, except I don't understand why there's so many of them, though they are very, very respectable scholars.
But can't a department be taken over by a group? When I was at Brooklyn College, which was a long time ago, the philosophy department was dominated by positivists. They were all Ayn Randian. Mm. And my philosophy teacher constantly complained that he was the only one who wasn't.
Right.
I assume that's no longer the case, but I could see a similar situation developing.
Well, now it would be Foucauldians, right? Mm-hmm. Or Butlerians. So here's Professor Berliner-Blau's law. Every tenure-track search for any position in the United States is like an ideological cloning machine, all right? All professors, no matter what their ideological preference, have this weird tick whereby they want to hire people whose worldview is similar to their own. And that's the job of the administration, by the way, to get in there and make sure that that logic doesn't play itself out.
You talk about a moral imperative that professors must invest into the minds of undergrads. How would you implement it?
Voltaire at the end of Candide, I believe there's a scene where they go to the wise man and they ask him for just knowledge. What do we do, right, in this world coming apart? And I think the wise man in French says, cultivez votre jardin, cultivate your own garden. So my advice to professors is class starts in 2 weeks. Just commit, right? Get excited. Spruce up your syllabus. Right? That's the only effective form of change that I can think of on the local level.
Are there a lot of people like you on campuses?
Yeah.
Why aren't we seeing more books?
I don't know, because nobody wants to write about this stuff. And there are lots of fuddy-duddies like me. I do feel we're a little bit afraid to kind of come out of the closet and talk about these issues. We're always seen as flimsy scholars, right? So, you know, what I tried to do is, as I was publishing the book, I kept updating my CV every 2 weeks, every time I would get a new peer-reviued scholarly publication, because I was like, oh, I know what they're going to say. It's like, oh, he's just a teacher, he's a popularizer. So that fear of being construed as not a serious academician is crippling in higher education. So I did kind of want to write the book as a person that has done some significant research and say teaching is as important as the research dimension.
Jacques Berliner-Blau is the director of the Center for Jewish Civilization at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. His latest book is called Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students, and it is published by Melville House. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
That was a lot of fun. Thank you, Leonard.